Welcome to another edition of the Financial Markets Insights in Conversation with podcast brought to you by The Realization Group. I'm delighted to be joined today by Kevin Formby of Keysight Technologies. Kevin is VP of Finance and Capital Market Solutions at Keysight, where he works at the intersection of trading infrastructure and precision measurement technologies. He spent more than 20 years in financial markets technology, where he helps firms understand what's really happening inside increasingly complex systems. And today's focus centers on a simple idea with big implications, which is that you can't optimize or trust what you can't see. To set the scene just a little bit, we all know that financial markets have never been faster. Latency has been compressed from milliseconds to microseconds to nanoseconds and even picoseconds. Speed is engineered, scaled, and in many cases, commoditized. But beneath that progress lies a more uncomfortable reality. Most firms still don't really understand what's happening inside their trading infrastructure. They can, of course, measure outcomes, trades execute, systems perform, but understanding why things behave the way they do is often far less clear. And increasingly, this isn't a technical gap, it's more strategic and regulatory. So today we're asking a simple question. If you can't see or measure what's happening inside your infrastructure, can you really trust it? Kevin, welcome.
Thanks, Tina. It's a pleasure to have a chat with you today and talk about some of the challenges in capital markets today.
Thank you. So for a start, your accent. So let's talk about, I know you've got an interesting background and you spent many years in financial markets, but that wasn't where you started out originally. Give us a quick overview of your journey from what is evidently a Northern English accent to Austin, Texas, and how it connects to what you're doing today.
Okay. I'm, as you can tell from the Northern English accent, I'm originally from Accrington, Lancashire. For those of you who don't know England very well, that's just above Manchester in the north of the country. Went to Birmingham University, got first class honours degree in electrical and communications engineering. And then I went off and worked in the defence industry for many years and then migrated into telecommunications and then into the fintech sector, and specializing on developing products to allow market participants to communicate to execution venues like exchanges in low latency and in easy to connect scenarios. So, you know, quite a wide background. In the defense industry, I was actually a radar systems engineer. I know all about how radar works and how we track aircraft and missiles and things like that. There's some really interesting lessons you can take from that kind of industry and apply them to capital markets, trading infrastructure. So kind of quite a wide background I've had. Also a professional engineer. I'm a chartered engineer in the UK. So I have a fairly in-depth background in both technology and in financial markets as well.
Thank you. I mean, that's fascinating on a number of fronts. Firstly, I can't help but go back to the accent. So the only thing I know about Accrington, I believe, is Accrington Stanley Football Club. But I also believe that's quite neat. You're originally actually from somewhere called Clitheroe, and I'm old enough to remember the Clitheroe Kid that my dad made me listen to of a Sunday morning on the radio. So it's nice to actually meet someone in real life from Clitheroe. That's fascinating in and of itself. And the fact that you've ended up, actually, we haven't really covered that. So how do you go from Clitheroe to Austin, Texas? Specifically, how have you ended up there?
I was working in the defense industry and the end of the Cold War, the industry was shrinking. So I went off and joined British Telecom, BT, and worked for them in some sales roles and also product management. And then I left them and went to work for a company called CETA, SMITA, and they provide networking services to the airline industry. And I was fairly successful in that career. And that company moved me to Atlanta, Georgia. And when I got to Georgia, I started talking to various customers in the finance sector. And it was clear there was a gap in the market. There wasn't an easy way to connect to stock exchanges from brokers or from buy sides. And I came up with an idea. I still remember the whiteboard in Atlanta where we drew a little fluffy cloud on it. And we said, why don't we build a private internet for the finance sector? And that idea mutated and it became the company known as Radians. And those of you who are in the connectivity side of capital markets know that Radians is a well-known name, BT Radiance. It had just been sold to TNS, but I was one of the original founders of Radiance. That's how I ended up in the capital markets area. After a career at BT Radiance, as it was known at the time, I moved on, became the CEO of a small company focusing on technology for financial markets, and then eventually became a vice president of finance and capital markets for a leading test and measurement company probably in the world, which is known as Keysight. And they moved me from Atlanta to Austin, Texas. Quite a long and varied move from Clitheroe in Lancashire to Austin in Texas. I can tell you certainly a couple of things. It's a lot wetter and colder in Clitheroe than it is in Austin, Texas.
That's for absolutely certain. Colder, definitely. That generally is fascinating, actually, Kevin. We had spoken before, but I don't think we'd realised how closely you were aligned with the inception of Radiance and then BT Radiance. And it is a timely reminder that actually both Radiance and other firms like Keysight presumably didn't necessarily start in financial markets, but recognised that there was a synergy between the types of technology that you're producing and their application to the modern trading world and trading infrastructure today. So that was actually going to be a nice segue into my second question. Clearly, there are lessons that can be learned from aviation or other sectors, defense, that involve high precision engineering systems that would apply directly to trading infrastructure today.
I think one of the biggest ones is don't fool yourself into believing that just measuring the outcome really allows you to manage your infrastructure. I'll give an example. If you're tracking an aircraft and you find out that you're measuring the position with an error of 100 meters, that's an interesting fact. But what's really more important is why are you 100 meters out, right? What can you do to fix it? So it's not the outcomes that are necessarily important. It's what's causing the outputs. And I think it's relatively easy to measure am I winning or am I losing, but why am I winning or why am I losing are more difficult questions to answer. But in the long term, that's the kind of thing that either gives you a competitive edge or it allows you to reduce your costs and the actual ROI of your trading infrastructure.
I think that's really an important point, particularly in financial markets. You know, you can benchmark your performance and say, oh, we're above the benchmark, or it's, you know, we're performing 99.9%. But to your point, that just tells you what's happened. It doesn't tell you why it's happened or what you should be doing or thinking about that would take that gap away. I think what we're saying is that you can have performance stats or analytics or things that tell you what is happening, but it's actually an illusion. It's an illusion of control if you don't really understand why it's happening. So if we could build on that a little bit. So we've already said markets are ever faster, more complex all the time, more venues, more assets, more instruments, more trading. So the question, I guess, is, are firms really in control of their infrastructure, or is there a gap between what they think they know and what's actually happening?
I think it depends. I think there are a small subset of customers who really understand it. I would put the top tier prop traders and HFTs in that category. But then I think there's a whole host of other people who don't really understand it. They're just focused on the outcomes and not on really understanding what's causing the outcomes. I think that's an issue. You know, some of these things do require a lot of specialist knowledge, so they're not easy to do. So you tend to drop to the lowest common factor and, you know, what's the crisis today? And companies focus on the crisis of the day rather than trying to stand back and look at the bigger issues about what's going on and try and address them. So you get into a downward spiral almost. The focusing on the crisis is not looking at the bigger picture, but because you're not looking at the bigger picture, you end up with more crises going on, right? And that distracts you from the bigger picture and you just keep on going downwards. So you do need to stand back and look at these bigger pictures and put the resources and the investment and the time to actually address them.
is one of the challenges here, just by its very nature, that the electronification of markets and fintech and technology itself, it means that a lot of infrastructure within potentially bigger financial institutions, maybe our older institutions, will by definition be legacy and knitted together from and layered, incremental layers of different products and systems and platforms and connectivity, so that there is no holistic view across the whole thing. It is very much people know the bit that they know, which is the bit that they work with, but there's no one actually has a full picture of the whole.
I would tend to agree with that. And you can see that particularly, I think, with the more established players. So larger organizations that have had a longer history, typical large brokers, I would put into that category. But then if you look at, say, a crypto trading company or a crypto execution venue, they're, they don't have the legacy systems to act as drives. So they're probably better at seeing the overall view. But if you're a lot larger organization with more of a history, then you have many, many systems. There's some connectivity between them, but it's very, very difficult to get a holistic view of what's going on and looking at the entire order processing or the trade execution chain, which, passes through everything from risk systems to algo development to smart order routing to gateways. There's a lot of systems that make up trade flow, and getting the holistic view of what's actually going on across all of those systems, and the different technologies that you use, the different protocols, different schemas, is challenging, and it's made worse when you have legacy systems out there as well.
So going back to that point of not being able to control what you can't see, also then would suggest that a tiny hidden issue that's occurring somewhere that people aren't looking can have a sort of snowball effect. And by the time you found it, isolated it, or determined by whatever method that it's having some impact, the impact's possibly been magnified. So the more quickly or the more visibility you have, the reverse is true, presumably. If you have full visibility, you're going to be far better able to proactively see where your weak links are, to use a phrase.
Yeah, I can give a good example of that. Taking in market data from exchanges or execution venues, typically people use multicast market data from exchanges. That multicast comes into a networking infrastructure. And because of multicast, they don't have really good error correction. They put things in them called sequence numbers in the packets. And those sequence numbers are used to actually measure where the packets have dropped and whether there's, ticks have disappeared. But if traffic comes into some infrastructure, network infrastructure, a packet may have disappeared or been dropped before it gets to the trading member. It could be, a network link. There's, one packet has got dropped. So the packet's dropped there, but then it goes through a whole series of systems internally. And it's only when it gets to the feed handler. Does the feed handler, it knows, there's a sequence number, let's do a retransmission. But the company actually knew, if it had the right tools in place, it would know that there was a sequence number gap when it hit the network layer. And that may be, literally hundreds of miles or hundreds of kilometers away. So, you've lost time in knowing what's gone wrong and, its impact on the business.
Actually, you mentioned time, which was another excellent segue. We're going to talk about both speed and time, because evidently they're not the same thing. But let's start, first of all, because I think we had one of the things you've just described probably is tied in with this, which is that for a long time, in my experience, the industry has been absolutely obsessed with latency. It just needs to get there faster. Just needs to be faster, 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 faster. And you can understand why. And from a time to market and competitive perspective, evidently, you want to be the first past the post. The need for speed in and of itself is not necessarily the only way that we should be thinking about performance, I think, given what you've just said. Performance, a bit like best execution, is a much bigger thing, which has far more contributing components than just latency itself. Would it be fair to say that we now should be looking at shifting towards something a bit more granular than just an absolute number that says you're going this fast or that transaction happened at this speed?
Yeah, I think a couple of things to do with latency. I think we're clearly getting to the point where, trying to shave another nanosecond off your infrastructure is a very expensive exercise. You're down at such a low level that it gets very difficult. We make products that measure when things happen, and we provide latency statistics on things like optical taps. And people are certainly asking us, what's the latency? And they want an answer that is a fraction of a nanosecond, which, you know, is a challenge to measure that kind of resolution. It's getting to the point where it's very, very difficult to push down the final single nanosecond. What I think people do want to know, though, is, has anything gone wrong in a live operational environment that has caused the latency to increase by a certain amount, but you know, you would be oblivious to it if you didn't have the right kind of monitoring tools in place. Latency is the time it takes to get from point A to point B. But to make that measurement, you need to measure when it left A and when it arrived at B. And to do that, you need highly synchronized clock sources. And that becomes a challenge in its own right. You hear all the time about people using GPS to measure time, and everyone says, oh, that's accurate to a nanosecond. That's not true. If you look at the statistics provided by people like the FAA in North America actually measure the accuracy of time at various locations, and you're probably only down at 10 to 20 nanoseconds. It's the accuracy of time provided by GPS. So if you're trying to measure the latency across 2 points, by the time you subtract off the difference between the two measurements, you could be 20 or 40 nanoseconds out. So it's quite a significant amount of inaccuracy caused by that. So I think there's an increasing emphasis on how on earth do I measure in real time the resolution of time correctly enough so I can spot that things are going wrong. Some carrier has redirected some circuit, so it was taking 5 milliseconds and now it's taken 5.5 milliseconds. Yeah, that's a significant difference. And you need to have the tools in place to do that kind of accuracy measurement. So I noticed we were doing a little bit of briefing earlier, Tina, about what we were going to talk about this. And you made some reference to Alice in Wonderland. And I found that was quite an interesting little comment you put down. Because I don't know if you know, there's a new technology to do with measuring time. It's called White Rabbit. I don't know if you know, that comes from Alice in Wonderland.
I absolutely knew the White Rabbit came from Alice in Wonderland, but I have to say that it was new to me in the context of what we've just been discussing and what you've just been so eloquent about, which is measuring time. So please tell us all more about the White Rabbit.
So White Rabbit came from a technology that came out of CERN. Right, and for those of you who don't know, CERN is an organization, I think it's on the border of Switzerland and France, and they have it's a large hadron collider, right, which is the big atom smashing machine. So they have a giant circle underground full of magnets, and they switch these magnets on very fast and in a synchronized manner, and they accelerate particles round, and they go around this great big circle underground. They put one anticlockwise and one clockwise, and they smash the two particles together, and they detect all of these weird subatomic particles that come out of it. And White Rabbit was developed as the technology to synchronize the magnets together very quickly. So, you know, you need super accuracy, and White Rabbit is capable of synchronizing time sources down to sub-nanosecond levels. So what you can do, and people have done this, is, as I mentioned before, if you're using GPS and you've got a GPS receiver for time cinch cargo, and you've got one in New York, both of those clocks could be out by 10 to 20 nanoseconds relative to each other. So what you could do, though, is if you've got a piece of fiber that runs from New York to Chicago, you could put White Rabbit timing signals over it, and you could synchronize, say, Chicago to New York. So in that scenario, now Chicago is always within, say, 1 nanosecond of the clock in Chicago. So you can now measure time and time differences between those two locations very accurately. So that's a good example of how, you know, precision is important going forward, and how some of these emerging technologies can be used to synchronize time very accurately. In fact, on our latest product that we'll be talking about at the TradeTech Europe event in a couple of weeks in Amsterdam, that actually is one of the first devices in the world that has a native white rabbit connection into it. So it can timestamp trading packets that go through it very accurately, down to probably 50 picoseconds accuracy, which is amazing. That's relative port to port. You're down at that kind of level.
So you've developed this, as you said, I think you said Keysight is the first entity to actually be using White Rabbit Protocol.
I think we're the first one to be using it natively. There's ways of that kind of simulating it, but this is certainly one of the first, I would say, using the technology.
Well, we sort of touched on defence, but I think equally there's an element of rocket science here, isn't there? You know, that we're now apparently going back to the moon. But again, as an analogy, it would be an illustration or an exemplar of where you need absolute precision timing and precision measurement of timing, because that is the difference, literally between life and death in terms of rockets to the moon. But that same technology, that rocket science technology, I think I jokingly said from NASA to NASDAQ when I was talking about it with you, your colleagues before. Going back to White Rabbit, because it's a bit technical for me, but is it something then from your perspective that supports how markets are evolving? Because we're moving towards T plus one and atopic settlement and even more automation. Is this about the importance of time accuracy and determinism as the market itself moves in the direction that it's going?
I think there's a little bit of a connection there, but I think it's more an issue of, you know, when you're comparing, when regulators are comparing when things happen, what do you do if there's some kind of market disruption goes on and someone wants to see, you know, what was the cause of it? Then you need to know very accurately when orders were taken in and sent, and you need to make sure that the time that, you know, separate commercial entities are putting on their trades are all synchronized to the same clock as much as possible. So, you know, there are regulatory requirements into things like MiFID II in Europe and FINMA regulations in the States, but they're, you know, down at hundreds of microseconds or even looser in the US. But if you're doing comparisons between what goes on, you need to be, you know, working at an order of magnitude more precision than what the regulators demand. So there is that angle to it.
Throwing this one at you randomly, is the move into potentially digital platform blockchain technology, atomic sort of trading, is that more or less likely to be time critical, you know, just because of tokenized assets creating that many more tickets theoretically?
I think there's that angle, which is the volume angle to it. But a lot of those technologies rely on time and time validity. One of the guys who worked for me, he did a fun little thing a couple of years ago. We decided to find out what happened if he changed the time on his laptop. He put it forward in time, and he did that, and two things happened. One is he suddenly couldn't get into any of our systems at work. And the second thing was he got a phone call from our IT security people saying, what the hell is going on? So time is important in terms of things like security. Invalid time is an indicator that something has seriously gone wrong. Time is used in the generation of all sorts of security tokens as well. So it is a key thing behind the scenes.
And I think, I mean, I love it. I've never been really into sci-fi, but the idea that, you know, time is different and relative depending on where you're measuring it from is obviously fascinating. And particularly to your point, if there's a dispute or a regulator wants to know, you know, to determine exactly what happened and when, it must be quite an interesting scenario if people's time doesn't match in that sense. Bit like you could have identical latency by the same logic, but it doesn't mean you're getting the same performance. The two things aren't necessarily the same. The time and latency can look the same, but not be the same.
Also, latency has counterintuitive impact on things sometimes. I'll give a good example. I spotted an article, about a couple of years ago might be New York Times or something like that, from like 1910, something like that. And they just constructed the first transcontinental telegraph service. from New York to California, and you could now send a telegram from New York to San Francisco, and they were saying it could get there in like 30 minutes from New York. And they said because of this, people in San Francisco could have access to financial market information really fast. And because of that, people would no longer trade in New York, and this would lead to the end of New York as a trading center. Well, it's actually the opposite has happened, doesn't it? Latency has reduced. It's made it more and more and more important to be in New York. It's an interesting kind of side effect of what's going on. Latency can lead to odd effects at times. It's not always what you think. It also kind of links into, going back to the theme about you need to measure stuff and everything. You know, I feel kind of sorry for some of the execution venues and even some of the prime brokers about all of this, because it starts to make a difference where you are. I think a lot of emphasis has been on like colo facilities and stuff like that. But what do you do if you're a broker and you buy side clients? How do you ensure that everyone is treated the same? A buy side might give you an order, but you've hit the broker infrastructure, one switch in a data center versus someone else in another switch. So the first one might actually have got their order into the broker's infrastructure before the other one, but because of some physical issue within the broker's infrastructure, they're penalizing the person who got their trade first. So it isn't just kind of where you are in the data centers and things, it's where you are with your trading counterparties and how does that all work together. I was dealing with some kind of opportunity earlier this week. I can't say who it was, but they wanted to normalize the latency from various European cities to London. So they wanted it so it didn't matter where their clients were in Europe, you would get exactly the same latency as if you were in London. So the only way they could do that was to delay the orders getting into their infrastructure in London to make it the same. And I think if you look, what's the distance from London to Frankfurt? Is it 500 kilometers, something like that? And if you looked at it doing a fiber cable, it worked out, I think it was 77 tons of cable, and it would actually take 4 trucks or lorries, if you're in England, to actually load it on, which is clearly not feasible. But I think it's an interesting dilemma going forward, how much are regulators and how much are brokers going to start to worry about their infrastructure and actually measuring what's going on in there to make sure that things are fair. I might comply with MiFID, but I might, as a buy side, I might not be happy knowing that my orders are always behind my competitors simply because of where I'm connected in a data center. So
that's a really good point, which I hadn't really thought of, but that makes for a sort of best execution, if you like. And again, to your point, even if you can't resolve it, this technology that you're talking about and that Keysight offers, you can at least say why what happened happened. So in the scenario that you've described, that's your orders coming in through two different switches, while one side may not be happy about that because they perceive that they were faster or they've been discriminated against, you're able as the broker to say, yeah, but this is why, and here's how we can resolve that going forward. You know, there is a solution, or it's just the way it is. You're still better informed than you otherwise would be, aren't you?
In fact, just before I came on this call, I was looking at a demo system we have about a product called X-Metrics, which we've jointly developed in conjunction with a company called Instrumentics. In fact, Keysight are a shareholder in Instrumentics as well. But I was looking at that and it was plotting graphs showing the latency within a broker's infrastructure, but showing it by buy-side client, right? So there was a lovely graph showing you, you know, what was the latency going to various execution venues per client, right? So it's exactly to check on the kind of thing you were saying. You've got to be careful here that you don't, as a broker, you don't disadvantage certain clients versus other clients. And if I was a buy-side company and I was doing anything vaguely latency sensitive, right, I'd be asking my broker, hey, can you just clarify what is the latency for me? You know, am I the worst latency of your buy-side clients, or am I the median or the 95th percentile? But then the brokers need to track at that kind of level, and it's not that easy to do.
Looking ahead, as markets become more continuous, more data-driven, more complex, what are the infrastructure decisions being made today or that should be being made today that will determine how firms, how well firms scale into the future? And I think you've touched on these, but to me, it sounds like things that are more observable, more measurable and more deterministic. Would that be a fair comment?
Yes, and it's going to have to be observability across multiple infrastructure instances. So I'll give an example. Today, if you were an exchange or a prime broker and you wanted to do some infrastructure changes, you'd probably do a change window maybe at night or maybe at the weekend. If everyone goes to 24-hour trading and they do it 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, then what do? You clearly, if you're going to do some work on the Sunday and you're trading on the Sunday, you would have to switch all of your trading over to your parallel infrastructure. Historically, failover infrastructure has been used, you know, in a disaster environment. In this environment, it's got to be used live, and you've got to track what's going on a lot more on your DR infrastructure as well as on your live infrastructure. On the DR side, right, you've got to do it maybe when it's not trading. So maybe that, you know, normally you're on your production environment, but you're ready to go on your failover system, but you need to be able to track how your failover system's going to handle the traffic if everything gets switched over. So I think there's some challenges to how you cope with redundancy and measuring things and making sure that, yeah, if you flick over to the backup systems, that things don't suddenly slow down or it doesn't work as forecast. So I think there's some challenges there. Moving away from just the technology side, I think there's going to be some human factors issues come into things here as well. You know, the stress on the teams that keep infrastructure going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week is going to be interesting.
I think you're entirely right. So it's not that you don't have the technical capability for 24/7 or 24/5, but the reality is, when do you do the testing? How do you do the upgrades? How do you ensure that there's no degradation of performance through doing any of these things? And again, I guess, as luck would have it, that rather lends itself to what your company and what you guys have focused on, which is actually helping them, again, to understand what's going on behind the curtain or under the bonnet so that they know what they should be looking at when they make those switches into the, you know, from production into the failover into redundancy. It all comes back to, it circles nicely back to the more you know, the better placed you are to know what you need to do next, I guess. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that would be fair to say. I will point one thing, Tina, for our American listeners who are listening in, I'll just do a little translation. The looking under the bonnet is the same as looking under the hood, right?
Indeed. And the other thing we should clarify is that behind the curtain is evidently a nod to the Wizard of Oz, which Americans will probably be familiar with, than Alice in, you know, Alice in Wonderland or Alice Through the Looking Glass. So all the analogies here work. White rabbits, Alice in Wonderland. Honestly, this is fascinating. And again, tell me a bit, just as we before we close, on what will you be doing at TradeTech this year, you personally and Keysight?
So a couple of things. I'll be on one of the panels talking with another panelist from the London Stock Exchange about some of the challenges with visibility, observability of infrastructure. So that should be interesting. We've got a small stand there. We'll be talking about our product X-Metrics, which is trade flow monitoring, our super low latency tap aggregation device called the Vision L25F. That's a device that uses White Rabbit, as we mentioned before, and that allows you to timestamp traffic very, very accurately and send it off to analytics tools like X-Metrics, and it can do it inline as well, so it's very low latency.
Something for everybody that might be attending TradeTech in any capacity, sell side, buy side, broker, execution venue, they should come and talk to you guys and evidently probably have a greater understanding of it after It is fascinating, this, and I definitely want to talk to you again and perhaps drill down into some of the specific things we've talked about today. I would like to say thank you so much. It really is interesting. Clear from the discussion that we are moving into perhaps a new industry phase where speed is no longer in and of itself the defining challenge, and that actually performance and certainty and the ability to see, measure and explain what's happening inside increasingly complex systems is going to be more of an imperative, whichever side of the trade you're on or whichever part of the life cycle you're in. It's not enough for infrastructure to perform, evidently. It has to be understood, it has to be defensible, and ultimately it has to be trusted. So hopefully our listeners today have got a bit more of a feel for how precision measurement in these types of technologies might be able to support them, again, whichever side of the trading fence they're sitting on. And they should come and talk to you in more detail and get a better understanding than I can convey. So thank you so much, Kevin, for your time. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you'd like to tell our listeners before we close?
I think there's an awful lot of things that we didn't touch on, but I don't think we have the time to discuss it. But it's been fun and a pleasure talking to you, Tina, and hopefully I'll see you in the coming weeks.
No, thank you so much for your time, and absolutely, let's revisit this and get into even more detail. Down the rabbit hole, you might say. We look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Cheers.